Okie doke.
Okay, whenever you're ready. I'm recording already.
Daniel in the Kitchen talks about food. Daniel in the Kitchen talks recipes. Daniel in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Daniel in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Thank you for joining us at our kitchen table today. Well, we've got a full show today. We're going to be talking, we kind of gather food news, and we have some items to share with you, and think Donna's got things to talk about recipes, and we've got a few good books to share.
Yeah, and Donna has a lot of bummer news. Sorry.
Well, before we get to the bummer news, which kind of, there's a lot in the news right now. Pickled eggs, Donna. Pickled eggs. Let's just.
Oh joy! Is this a pre-Easter?
Well, this is pre-Easter for me because
it means your chickens are starting to lay more eggs.
Okay, so all right. This is good. So, I have a container in my refrigerator that is just full of wonderfully hard-boiled eggs that are bright pink, and they're bright pink, because they are pickled in once used pickled beet juice.
Oh.
I got a really nice crisp.
Now that's recycling.
Yeah, that's recycling. Yeah. I got a really nice jar of pickled beets from my neighbor Julie for Christmas and got them out about a month ago. And the juice was just too good to throw away.
Oh, yeah. Why waste it?
Why waste it? So I just saved the juice and put some hard-boiled eggs in it and waited about 3 days, and sure, good. What a good adventure.
I love pickled eggs. You know, if you don't have any recycled beet juice, you can, well, let's see, what it's, so it's water, vinegar, a little sugar.
Salt and pepper.
Sure. And then if you want the pink color, you just drop the beets in or something. You don't even have to. Do you have to cook it?
I didn't cook.
Well, because it was already done. It was recycled.
I think if you wanted to start from scratch, I would warm up the pickledy stuff just to make it warm.
Right, and cook the eggs separately and then drop them in. I mean, it's considered old bar food, but I don't know, since I don't habituate bars, I like having them in the refrigerator. So.
Yeah. There you go.
A quick protein shot.
And yes, they get pink. And as you wait farther and farther to eat them, the pink gets into the whites. And eventually, it's just starting to tinge the yellow. And it really is good. So thinking ahead to Easter and eggs and pickled eggs.
Spring, fertility.
It's a good thing.
To all of that sort of thing.
Well, let's get to our bummer news, Donna. We got to do that. And it's good to know what's going on in the world of food. And here
I almost hate to do the bummer news right now because there's so much bummer news everywhere.
Anyway, so tick-a-dick, 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 tick-a-dick. That is the Donna Lana ticker tape news department. Take it away, Donna.
We're talking about plastics.
Plastics.
And plastics in the environment and the longevity of them. Lana, she's got the article about plastics in the ocean.
Oh, okay.
Which is, people are talking about a lot, right?
Plastics in the ocean, okay.
Microplastics.
Yeah, well, no, we're thinking of all the stuff that's bobbing around and getting caught in sea turtles and dolphins and things. But what is of more concern is something called microplastics. And
you can't see them, you can't taste them, you can't feel them.
And it's getting all over. It's chemicals that are used in a range of products, including carpets, furniture, clothing, food packaging, and nonstick coatings, are now showing up in the ocean. And what's bothering...
Right. They break down to invisibility for the human eye.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're, you know, plastics are... They exist a long time. It's not as long as radiation, but it's pretty long.
Yeah,
like hundreds of years.
Yeah, It's what we're doing to ourselves, you know? Okay, these little particles are less than 5 millimeters in length, which are about the size of a sesame seed, and they invade the food chain, starting with all those folks that live in the ocean. And what is concerning, besides the fact that it's just plain concerning, is that because of how seawater moves around, all kinds of high concentrations of this stuff are showing up in the Arctic Ocean, way up there sloshing around where the polar bears are. And you think, well, what in the world are they doing there? But if it's that high there, it goes elsewhere. Emerging research suggests that one important pathway, okay, it's not just sloshing around in the ocean, but they've kind of watched this stuff. And what can happen is that it actually can be starting to be dispersed through the air and rainwater.
Oh, right. It's light enough to get picked. There is a quote here from Common Dreams. Scientists believe at the current rate of plastic pollution buildup, the weight of plastics in the world's ocean, quote, could exceed the collective weight of all the fish in the ocean.
Oh, come on, folks. Here we go.
Blech.
Okay.
Blech.
Okay, this is
I remember. Okay, so plastic bags. Everybody, we've been using plastic bags our whole life. Mm-hmm. There was a point where they came up with this new thing, and the plastic bags started to look different, like a little cloudier, mm-hmm. a little softer. And the deal was that these plastic bags they call them biodegradable, but what really happens is they are in fact not biodegradable. They put some kind of cornstarchy thing in the plastic that causes the plastic to disintegrate to a level of non-visibility.
So somehow non-visibility does not mean non-toxic.
No, it's like you just can't see it. So that makes the problem visually go away. But you know, us humans, we got fooled by that one, I have to say.
Once again, fool us once, shame on us, or two, and fool us
again. Yeah, well,
we're still fooling us,
so, you know. Although, in the same article, it said that 75% of the world people polled in a recent global survey believe single-use plastic should be banned.
Well, yeah.
Okay, that's...
It's really hard to get away from it.
So that's the ocean plastic.
Also, just as long as we're on oceans, I want to mention seafood. Findings suggest that people who regularly eat seafood are also regularly eating plastics. This study said that a seafood eater could be exposed to approximately 0.4 milligrams of plastics when ingesting the average serving of oysters or squid, but up to 30 milligrams of plastic when eating sardines for comparison. It says a grain of rice weighs about 30 milligrams. So 30 milligrams of plastic in your basic sardine.
Yeah. Now, you can't, don't think you can get away from this by simply not eating fish, right? This is an article from Civil Eats, and the headline is, Ocean Plastic is Bad, but Soil Plastic May Be Worse. It says, according to a recent UN report on plastics in agriculture, the Earth's soils may be more saturated with plastic pollution than the oceans. You know, we think about, I'm trying to think in Iowa, it's probably the most obvious thing is like Lana and I like to have local greens. Okay. In the winter in Iowa, that means it's got to be in a greenhouse. Now, aren't most of those greenhouses, we're not thinking glass greenhouses anymore. Mm-hmm. We can't do that in Iowa. Mm-hmm. We get one tornado and a bunch of hail and bingo, it's gone. So these high tunnels are all covered in plastic,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're probably used for a few years, but eventually, I don't know, what do you think is the average lifespan of a covering on a plastic greenhouse?
I'm not an expert here, but plastics on greenhouses have been improved. So it's not just like a one-year sort of thing, but But solar radiation, sun is really hard on plastic. But they last for, it's a couple of years now. It's radiation. One of the things about it, so that's a lot of plastic. Okay. But consider also, especially in vegetable production.
Yes.
In this state and others.
Right, especially in California. This is where you see it all. It's strawberry production.
So much is on the ground.
Fields of plastic. Like there's a city north of Los Angeles called Oxnard, which is, they call themselves the, something like strawberry capital of the world, right? It's a coastal plain, so it gets the right temperature for the strawberries. And, I mean, just like you see cornfields here, you see the strawberries there. But between the strawberry rows, it's all planted into plastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
well, it's handy. It's handy, but that does break down. I tried growing on plastic quite a few years ago because I found I didn't like it. Because even if you pull it up, by the time you're pulling it up by the end of the season, it's all falling apart, and I am still, we're talking, this was like 8-10 years ago. I still pull up little bits, and this is stuff I can see. I pull up wads of
clumps of it.
And, of course, I can't see the little bits. This article is talking about little bits of plastic in soil,
you know, once it breaks down, you can't really even, it's like in the ocean, it's hard to get it out. You can't, I mean, they're doing things in the ocean where they're making these kind of booms that collect the larger bits of plastic and pull it out and carry it off and stuff. Yeah, we can get the bigger stuff, but the little, once it's in there, I mean, we've resorted to, for example, yoga clothes. All the stretchy, you know, non-cotton polyester, all of that stuff is also putting the microplastics in. You wash your clothes, some of it comes off into the, goes back into the water system. So there now are little kind of, I don't know, filters that you can put on your washing machine that collect the microplastics so that, I mean, I don't know where you're supposed to put them here.
Then you take the filter out and wash it and put it down the drain.
Yeah,
exactly.
Here is the major overall takeaway that we all need to understand. As the uses for pet, because plastics are made from petroleum, all right? It is a product of oil. So one of the things the petrochemical industry, and you know who we're talking about, as we're doing the, you know, get better gasoline, use less fossil fuels, you know, green energy, blah, blah, blah. What they're doing is they are ramping up plastic production all over the world, bigger and bigger factories, more and more uses. You know, it's like in my mind, there's a little cartoon and there's the board members saying, well, you know, if we can't put it in the cars, we'll just make other uses for it and sell this gas somewhere else. And so plastics is the place it's going. And, there are some good news. Like, for example, with this agricultural thing, they're trying to litigate and make it so that the producers of, because the farmers, you know, in the instance of agricultural, you know, depends. Yeah, maybe some of it can be recycled. Most people live where there probably isn't that kind of recycling. And then we all know what's happening to recycling lately. It gets dumped somewhere else and nothing is, you know, it's not, recycling is not the answer. Not that we should stop recycling. However, in early March, 175 nations agreed to a historic plastic pollution treaty. Okay. That's the headline. However, it's not the real treaty. They've agreed to meet and discuss it, and the treaty is going to come in 2024. The resolution calls on countries to hammer out a final treaty, which could, this is good, ban single-use plastics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if we started there, they make up the vast majority of all the plastics in the world. Only 9% of single-use plastic is ever recycled. Well, okay, 79% is incinerated. Okay, now we do incinerate plastic here in Ames, only a few blocks from where we're sitting right now. It's, according to many people in Ames, our recycling plant is a good thing. It doesn't produce dioxins because it's such a high temperature, blah, blah, blah. I've been told this many times. However, there are scientists that disagree with that. I have to say, as long as I've lived in Ames, which is 15 years, I have asked questions about this because I live right in the neighborhood where we're burning all of our plastics, right? It has never been tested. The Ames incinerator has never been tested. We just assume that, you know, it is not producing dioxins because that's what we were told by the company and the engineers that built the thing. So, just saying. I don't know. So, anyway, back to this treaty here. What they're trying to do is ban single use, which would be a good idea. Because there are things in our culture and in our world, just like with gasoline and other petrochemicals, where we really need it. We haven't gotten to the point where we invented something that's better. But this treaty is trying to help people to understand that... if we get rid of the plastic bags and the throw away this and the ba-da-ba-da and save the plastics for things like we need them for some medical uses, although medical use is a lot of throwaway plastic too because you can only use it once. We have made life so complicated on this planet. So the United Nations Environmental Program, that's an acronym, UNEP, said that the agreement marked a historic day in the campaign to beat plastic pollution, which was responsible for more greenhouse gas pollution in 2015 than all the world's airplanes combined. Hello. Okay, so at least we're talking about it. You know, that's the good news.
Is the United States part of this?
Well...
I hope.
They didn't actually. I asked the same question. It did say, so the forum was held in Nairobi, but it says, Africa is not a major producer of chemical plastics, okay? This is from the co-chair of the committee. Yet countries, including the U.S., export more than 1 billion pounds of plastic waste to countries all over the world. The U.S., the second largest plastic producer in the world after China, has yet to sign on to the 2020 agreement limiting plastic waste exports. Okay.
Oofta.
Oofta, yeah, right. And we all know that, you know, when legislation or even a treaty starts to heat up, then all the vested interests come in with a lot of money from their lobbies and try to water it down and make it so that it means that they can keep on doing business as usual. So, you know, that's the latest thing that...
Okay. I consider that some bummer news, Donna.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to some more bummer news.
Okay. Second item on my list. Okay. This is about, what's that word I can never pronounce? Neonicotinoids. Anyway, those are the things that we have found. You know, we now know it's clear we have an insect decline, a pollinator decline, the bees are dying. Hello, how long can this go on? You know, it's like you think, oh, we're getting rid of insects. Oh, good, no more mosquitoes. Excuse me. Well, the mosquitoes feed the birds, right? They feed on us, then they feed the birds, and then the bird, you know. So we also are, of course, having a bird population decline. And and this is very much relevant in Iowa. I have to say that... the main headline is that the EPA is poised to allow 15 more years of neonicotinoids. Despite moves by the European Union who have banned them and other countries who are seriously restricting them, right? So for, and this is a 15-year thing. So even though the agency, the EPA, has noted ecological risks of concerns, particularly to pollinators and aquatic invertebrates, because what happens, these chemicals, which are widely used on crops to treat them for pest infestation, right? The main use of them for Iowa is that it is a seed coating put on almost all the corn and soybeans. So they put the insecticide right on the seed. You know, you think, oh, okay, then, you know, it works. But the problem is, okay, it says nicotinoids are used across 150 million acres of American cropland and roughly the size of Texas and have contributed to the land becoming 48 more times toxic than it was 25 years ago. The chemicals are water soluble and quickly leach out of the plants and into the soils and streams, causing such harmful impacts to wildlife that Canada has restricted their use and the EU has banned them out of doors completely. So in Iowa, so one of these articles had a map, U.S. map, showing where that level of pollution is the most intense. You know, it's one of those little colored dots, and you look at Iowa, it's completely colored, because so much of it is on the seed coating. Now, the terrible part of this is...
You mean the more terrible part?
Okay, well, all right, we'll call this one the ridiculous part. Quote from the article, these insecticides are not helping the productivity of crops on fields. It seems to be an amazing effort to blanket all these acres with something that doesn't have a return on investments. These seeds are marketed so well to farmers, they become scared that they will have catastrophic outbreaks of pests if they don't use them, even though this is unlikely. So, it's a marketing thing. Again, it's the seeds are, you know, from the usual suspects where we buy all of our seeds in Iowa that, you know, it comes on the GMO seeds and, you know, it's part of the, what do you call it, the pesticide treadmill. And it's really probably not going to have a, I mean, the science at this point is clear to several things. It drastically infects insect populations. Okay, folks, so if insects are dying and it's in all of our land, air, and water, it can't be very good for the humans either. So that's they're not even doing research on that. But it's clear that the insect populations are in decline. And the other thing has become clearer over time that it actually does not give a larger yield. So why the hell are we using this stuff?
Yeah, here we are. What are we doing?
Why are farmers sold this through advertising campaigns that they have to pay extra for a seed that does this, that's actually costing them more money? Probably, I mean, the science is pretty clear. It is not really effective in terms of boosting yield that much. So, and I think, there, not being a farmer who buys this kind of seed, I think they're not cheap either. So, why are we doing this? We're shooting ourselves in the foot. Okay, that was it for my bummer news.
Oh, good. Donna, I think we should take a little bit of a break.
Okay.
Why
okay.
are we doing this? Let's come back with some other thoughts. But this is stuff.
Yeah, let's go back to baking our brownies, for goodness sake.
But this is stuff we need to know, Donna, because this has something to do with baking brownies. It really, and that's where the brownies come from. Okay. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. We are back. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. Well, today we've been dealing with some, as Donna calls it, bummer news. There are things going on in our world that you just couldn't make it up. And it is not good, all the things about pesticides and plastics. And I think we are smart enough to do something
different. Lana and I were young girls. What was it, better living through modern chemistry or something? What was that saying?
It's something like that. And in The Graduate, plastics, the movie, that was the future. That was the future. It was. However, maybe that isn't the road we should go down on.
We've gone a long ways down it. So
we have to make choices, and we have to learn to make better choices and take more responsibility for our food, because a lot of this has to do with food production.
You know, when we say that, we have to make choices that puts it back on the individual consumer, which is, it has become an effective industry of, I mean, do we really have choices?
Well, no, because capitalism works, Donna. It does. It does. Capitalism tells us.
Well, I suppose, but you know, more and more people are saying this needs to be regulated, and it's only going to work if the voices of the people are actually put into come up against the greed, excuse me, of industrial necessities or not necessities. So. Mm-hmm. Don't think you have to do this all on your own, but do speak up in any political way that you can.
Very good. We can do that. Here in the Donna Lena Kitchen, we encourage you to prepare more meals for yourself and take control of what you eat. You can do that. Cooking.
Be informed about where your food is coming from and what's been done to it and how it affects you and your family and, you know.
Here we go. Cooking food doesn't have to be daunting. Donna has a few things to say about recipes. Donna has a few things to say about how to take culinary advice with a grain of salt. Take it away, Donna.
Well, I had a piece that I wrote for a cookbook, I don't know, golly, more than 10 years ago. And I called it The Tyranny of the Recipe, and really I wrote it as an introduction to the recipes that I was writing in the book. And partially I did that because when I write a recipe, I try not to make it so precise that you have to have this ingredient and run out to the store and buy it if you don't have it. And I think as I write recipes, I personally want the recipe to be a kind of a loose-knit structure that encourages one to explore and taste and rely upon one's own judgment. I think this was written, you know, more than 10 years ago, and I think it's only intensified, like, because people watch a lot of food television and, you know, somehow a lot of cookbooks have become what I call food porn, which means they set impossible standards. They have beautiful pictures and really, in some senses, even though they're most meant to be encouraging, I think what they do sometimes is they discourage one about one's own ability and one's own creativity. It's much in the way if somebody is watching too much porn, they start to denigrate the reality of the body that they have and the people around them. You know, it's like some kind of impossible standard. So what I want to do is, I'll read just a little bit of this, but I wrote, recipes are useful guidelines, especially if family culinary traditions have been obscured by a recent generation or two that didn't really enjoy hanging out in the kitchen, eating and blessing together. But to really understand, enjoy cooking and food, forget about being a slave to the recipe. So basically, recipes are cooking methodologies founded like a map, kind of, or a treasure hunt or something. You still have to find your own way. And I think a good recipe will either tell you something about maybe the cultural traditions and heritage of something, or even maybe basic nutrition and how to handle certain produce or provenance or something like that.
I find the best cookbooks have got the stories about them.
Yes, exactly.
And even when you get a recipe from a friend, the story behind the food is often the best part. That's what makes you hungry.
Yeah, and I think historically, first of all, recipes have only really been written down predominantly. Well, there were some maybe 1850s cookbooks, but it's really more a 20th century invention. You know, our foremothers and fathers, our ancestral mothers, cooked agriculturally, kind of based on geography, weather patterns, where they came from, the communities they lived in, and there were no food fashions. People cooked consistently, mostly the same kinds of things for hundreds and hundreds of years and many, many generations. So you really learn from it. It was passed down as an oral tradition, much like any other craft. You kind of watched and learned, and the main thing is tasting. You know, I'm what I call a tasting cook. I see these people who turn out food and they haven't tasted the whole thing. They're just kind of following the list of things. So when I'm cooking, I keep a whole pile of spoons next to me to dip in and take a taste at almost every step of the way. My most basic instruction really is to taste as you go along. If the flavor pleases you, it will taste good to other people. I often get asked, I think this is the most frequent question, is how long should I cook it? And I go, my answer is, cook it till it's done.
That's true.
Well, because even in a, you know, a very formal recipe, when they set up, they'll give you a temperature and they'll give you a time. However, there are so many variables. First of all, hardly anyone's oven is really the temperature that it says it is. And also, you know, things like humidity and weather and moisture content and, you know, air pressure. All of these are variables. So I noticed one thing when I'm cooking, just before something starts to be done, especially if it's in the oven, but not just in the oven, there's a smell that comes out of it. And you know that smell because all of a sudden you go, oh, it's starting to smell like you think it's supposed to.
Or, oh, did I forget it? Or did I? Well, maybe I better look.
No, that's,
oh, that's too far.
When it's
too
late,
okay.
Right? When it first starts to smell really good is when it's very close to being done. And that's when you kind of need to start watching. Like a professional chef can, oh, like for cooking meat, you can, or fish even, you can press on the meat or the fish with your thumb and know by the feel of it, just if it's medium rare or if it's at the right, you know, or sometimes just poking a fork in it, how easily does the fork go in? You know, these are tactile things that I would encourage you to do. Taste it, feel it, poke it.
Look
you
at
know,
it.
You
yes,
know, all of yes. that kind of thing. What I do, the only cookbook I really, really recommend is, of course, The Joy of Cooking. I think it has every basic thing that most Americans would really, really want. And they give you kind of a good starting point, you know. And then one thing I often do in any recipe that I'm reading that's printed is I will up the herb and spice content, not the salt. And there are only a few herbs that you can have too much of, like you can use too much rosemary, for example. What else can you use too much of that you could really overdose on? Not very many things.
Cayenne pepper.
Oh, yes, that's a very individual thing. The heat of a dish is pretty.
Yes, this idea of trusting your senses. After all, the whole idea of this is to feed ourselves. I don't think we have lost the ability to know what's good for us, even though we may be really out of practice.
Well, and it's also cooking is a very creative process. So if you're using your own sensory apparatus, your smeller and your taster, to kind of make a creation, you own it. It's kind of like painting, I think, in some senses, only it disappears immediately and it doesn't have to go in a frame on the wall. But it's like you're saying, this is my taste. And that word taste has many meanings other than the literal, but this is so literal. And I think it's more of a pleasure if you're cooking it the way you want to, and you can enjoy that, and you can offer it to your friends and your family with your own confidence and your own pleasure in the cooking, you know. So it's not a tedious thing.
And don't be set back by what you consider mistakes. If things don't taste right,
keep going.
Keep going. Learn. Say, oh, just do it a little different next time. And yes, the food, I often think vegetables talk to you. I understand it does that when they're growing, for one thing. Are vegetables happy? Are they in the right place? Do they have enough water? But also, as they're cooking, you can watch them, you can taste them. Is this right? Are they ready? Yeah, sure.
Well, and another thing, you know, if something doesn't taste quite the way you expected to, it may not be that you've underdone it, overdone it. You may have underdone it. Sometimes you need to add more of this, that, and the other. One thing I do as I'm kind of, you know, if I'm experimenting, I will have some little dishes, and I'll take a couple spoonfuls of something and put it in a separate dish and go, okay, now what would happen if, say, I added more mint or if I added more of this? And I'll put a little bit into a sample dish and see if I like that flavor before I take on the whole pot of it.
Oh, that's a good idea, instead of just throwing it right in the pot.
Yeah, because if you've oopsed, you haven't oopsed the whole dish, you know, you can have a little sample. It's rather like if you're going to paint a new color on the wall, you paint a sample piece to see, oh, can I live with that color? You know, so you can do little tastings along the way. I often use saucers and little monkey dishes, they're called, for that sort of thing. But the most important thing is to develop your own confidence and your own set of taste buds that please you.
That was a little bit from the Donna Lana Kitchen Archives. Some good advice by Donna. Thank you. Now, people sometimes think cooking is daunting, is something, oh, careful, we can't really do it. But surprisingly, these past few years living with COVID, people have dipped down and sought some other skills out, or more meals were being made at home. And there has been this phenomenon of meal kits. What do you think about meal kits, Donna?
Well, Lonnie and I, we tried one, and we did a radio show about it. I don't know, maybe five or more, well before the pandemic.
When they were just first starting, this meal kit.
Yeah, it's obviously for somebody like Lonnie and I, it's not really...
It's not as much fun.
No, it's not necessary, basically, but... So when people couldn't, like, have takeout easily or go to restaurants during the pandemic and they realized they didn't know how to cook, the meal kit industry was really, really boosted. It's, you know, companies like Blue Apron was one of the early ones, and there are several. I mean, it became a big deal, you know, very complicated industry because it's delivered right to your home, right? And... it actually grew up as a growing segment of the food industry the same way deli and prepared foods in supermarkets. I mean, if you'll notice, even our local large supermarkets in the past 15 years have really upped their prepared food offerings because, you know, who had time to cook? So anyway, with this meal kit delivery, now that we're into, you know, finished 2 years of the pandemic, we were trying to figure out what has happened to this business. And so I happened in the New York... No, sorry. This was in the Washington Post. They did some statistics on it that said meal kit delivery companies flourished early in the pandemic that are struggling now. And the takeaway of the article was when people didn't really know how to cook, they learn from the meal kit because the meal kit comes with the right... all the ingredients and the recipe laid out, do this, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So for people who didn't know how to cook, they learned to cook that way. Now that they have learned how to cook, they're not really using the, you know, they have, as a learning technique, it was very effective. But I don't think that's what the meal kit companies were planning for, because, of course, now the consumer, well, you know, people are not subscribing anymore because now they know how to cook and they realize how simple it is, and they can just, which I think is a really good thing. Sorry, meal kit companies, but, you know, it was good for that. Okay?
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. For more information about the Donalana Kitchen and this fine community radio station, go to www.khoifm.org. And for the Donalana Kitchen, you can find us there. You can find our webpage. It has archives. It has recipes. More than you ever want to know about the Donalana Kitchen. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Every now and then on the Donalana Kitchen, Donna and I share books. We get one and we go to the library, or Donna orders something. And what we like to do is, what's the kind of book we like to read anyway, related to food, farming, nature, living systems. All this kind of stuff inspires us. We have a couple books we'd like to share, and the first one I'd like to talk about is called Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey by James Rebanks.
Okay, I have to say, both of the books we're going to talk about today are nonfiction books, all right? This is my anti-bummer news kind of thing. This is what I read to, you know, I mean, it's hopeful material, let's say, okay?
It is.
Yeah.
Actually, we've talked about James Rebanks, who is a shepherd.
An English shepherd. From the Lake District.
Which is in, kind of in the upper left-hand corner of the British Isles, up there, kind of just below Scotland. A lovely man. Yeah, he actually came and visited Central Iowa a couple years ago for the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference and talked about... He's not a large-scale farmer. He's kind of reinventing and rediscovering his family's way of farming and enjoying it. And one nice thing about him is that not only does he have a lot of farming skills, he's also a good writer. He, as a young man, he went off to Oxford and learned how to tell a tale. He can write very well.
Yeah, and he's not an old farmer either. He's still...
Oh, he must be maybe my age or something, a little younger.
Oh, no, I think he's probably in his 50s.
Okay, 50s.
Right, because he's still got young kids.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, James Rebanks runs a family-owned farm in the English Lake District, and he's also written The Shepherd's Life, which was his first big kind of blockbuster book. In England, it was one of those first books or one of the books that got people really interested in acknowledging farmers. He has a good way of talking to all of us about relating to the land. It was named one of the 10 best books of the year. And he also has another thing that he's been doing for a long time. He's on Twitter. He's on Twitter. And you can find out more about him at Herdy Shepherd 1. H-E-R-D-Y Shepherd 1, at Herdy Shepherd. There are people all over the world that follow his stories.
Right, he does a lot of pictures of, you know, the baby sheep and the, you know, the beautiful pastoral things.
And now, just because you're on a small, well, relatively small, beautiful countryside, does not mean that he grew up where people were taking care of the land. He talks about the fact that big agriculture and monocrops started coming to his valley, too. And he was told that he had to get bigger and get out. And it's amazing. It's amazing. He kind of decided to stop that whole thing and kind of listen to the land more. And it's working, too. It's his journey about farming. He says, and what's really nice is he talks well about it. Here's a quote from him. Most people are now largely illiterate when it comes to agriculture and ecology. This is a cultural disaster because the global challenge of how we live sustainably on this planet is a real local challenge. How can we farm in ways that will endure and do the least harm? And what does that local farming produce for us to eat? The economists are wrong. Farming is not just any other business. Farming is a business unlike any other because, crucially, it must take place in a natural setting, and it affects the natural world directly and profoundly. The book is called Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey by James Rebanks.
Yeah, and of course it's, you know, for non-farming people, it gives you a real window into what the actual conundrums are, the joys, the pain in the rear end, and you know, he's so, and his sheep, and now he has cattle as well. Mm. The whole point of his farming, he explains, is how he takes his clues from what the land actually needs, and the animals get moved around according to that, and how it benefits all of them. Mm-hmm. And he says, his tenure on that piece of land, so he learned from his father, from his grandfather, but it's a long lineage going back to as far as he knows, he is the sort of aboriginal person on that part of the world. I mean, you know, we think of Native peoples as either Native Americans or, you know, some other kind of person. But, you know, white people had tribes and lived in certain places of the earth many hundreds of thousands of years ago. So it's lovely to hear from a man that feels that rooted to the place. I mean, no white Americans can say this because we weren't born. Born on this continent, but our ancestors were not. So it's lovely to know that tradition. Now, another book that also speaks to that tradition is called To Speak for the Trees. Diana, how would you pronounce that? Beresford Kroeger. Kroeger. K-R-O-E-G-E-R. So this woman is, on her mother's side of the family, she's Irish. But she is descended from a certain part of Ireland where some of the last remaining Druidic and Celtic people still existed. I mean, with St. Patrick's Day, we have to remember a lot about the Irish history, which is the dismal part is it was once forested by oaks, completely, you know, a forest, as were many other parts of the world, right? So the English came and cut down all the oak trees, the 100 and some of them 1,000 years old, and just reduced the countryside of Ireland to a flat, kind of stony, rocky place, which it remains to this day. But the original people of that land, of which Diana Beresford Kroeger's ancestors were the Celts, and their leaders were called Druids. Those were their medicine people, their religious leaders, their political leaders. And of course, like all indigenous people, they had an oral culture, which was nature-based. So the original alphabet of the British Isles was something called Ogham? O-G-H-A-M or something? And it has 20-some letters, all of which are named after different trees or different plants that are, you know, related to trees, like oak, ivy, things that we have a lot, hazel, things that we grow here in Iowa. So she wrote this book because her biography, she has several other books. One of them is called The Global Forest, and I believe there's even a film. So who she is, she was orphaned at an early age, like 13 or something. Both of her parents died. So she was sent back to Ireland, and an uncle said, okay, we'll take her on. But really what he did was place her in the community of her ancestors. And the older people there decided that she would be the one to be taught all of the old ways. So she was sent around to different people in the community to learn a lot about herbology and, you know, the way people did things, the way they used plants, how they lived, how they used their medicines. And she learned all of this. Then she went on to study botany and medical, she was a botanist and a medical biochemist. So what she has spent her life doing is actually exploring the biochemical properties that explain scientifically the things that she was taught, because of course folk medicine is often discounted. But she talks about, she's discovered something which she calls the mother tree, that there are certain trees in forests, and these are the very old ones, you know, that are propagating and creating root systems and through the soils and the biochemicals that carry these things. She also is able to explain, for example, if you're in a forested area, the certain trees are exuding volatile chemicals. So you can walk into a forest and she can tell you which plants are exuding things that might be antibiotic, antibacterial, antidepressant. These are plant medicines that have discernible biochemical elements, and some of which we are starting to be able to understand, because of course this stuff is so complex that, you know, human beings have only begun to deal with it. So her whole thing, and she lives in Canada and has done for many years, is to, first of all, she was very active with the Native Americans in Canada to protect the boreal forests, which are as large as the Amazonian rainforest and as significant. You know, trees, first of all, produce oxygen. Hello, before we had trees on the planet, the carbon was so heavy that, you know, humans did not exist then. We cannot live in a carbon-saturated environment where the air is. We need oxygen. So trees do that first and foremost. But they also do a lot of other things. Like she was quoting an old saying in Japan, if you want to have fish, plant a tree. Because she discovered, of course, the trees drop their leaves, and then it biodegrades into certain things. And if it's along the river, then the river carries it out to the ocean. And then those areas where the ocean meets the land, all of a sudden, there are a lot of different sea creatures that come there to breed and feed. And why is this? Well, she tracked down what the chemicals were and what it was causing in the ocean that fed larger amounts of things in these areas. This stuff is not old folklore. It is scientific reality, some of which we just as human beings have not been sophisticated enough to understand the complete networking of. So in this book, she talks about, it's called To Speak for the Trees, My Life's Journey from Ancient Celtic Wisdom to a Healing Vision of the Forest. So it's a delightful read. She's still very optimistic, and she has worked her whole life to preserve nature on the planet.
Two good books.
Yes.
To Speak for the Trees and Pastoral Song. Thanks for joining us at our kitchen table today. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you through the studios of KHOI Community Radio. And we come to you live at noon. And also you can find out more at the KHOI website. There's streaming, there's archives, there's all kinds of things. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had Excellent Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.